So we're in this series called Real Issues, Real Voices, where we've been tackling some tough questions and some tough topics, topics that we think are important, topics that people are talking about in our culture, and yet topics that can often be controversial and honestly very political. And so we've been navigating them and asking the question, what does our faith say about these? Because we can't just ignore them. They're important. And we believe God has a perspective on these, and we believe our faith should inform our perspective. And so we want to put those questions on the table and discuss them as a church, and as a community of faith. And so, as you can see, we've hit some of the big ones. And tonight we're going to be talking about immigration. And I couldn't be more excited to have Dr. Danny Carroll, who's going to come up in just a second. So let me just introduce him and tell you who he is before he comes up here. He's a professor at Denver Seminary, a professor of Old Testament. A number of years ago when I went to seminary there, I had him for Old Testament. I had him for third semester Hebrew, which was fun. I still remember my Jonah paper on Nahum. You can ask him what that means. And he teaches a number of courses there, and I can't say enough about how much his thinking and his teaching shaped my perspective and my outlook on my faith. He sits on a number of boards of great organizations. He's written a number of journal articles and books. A book that came out recently called At the Border, Christians at the Border, about immigration and the Bible. And so I think, do you have copies here tonight? Yeah, so he's got some copies, so if you want to dig a little deeper in what we're going to talk about, you can buy one of those from him after the service. But maybe more importantly than all of those, he's half Guatemalan. And so he grew up spending a lot of time down in Guatemala with family down there. He's been to the area where some of you have been. We've gone down and done partnership trips at Lake Atitlan and San Pedro and San Pablo. He's familiar with that area. And of course, he's familiar with the issues of immigration and what it looks like when people from Central America and Mexico and places are coming to this country, and the issues that it's brought about in this country, and how we need to begin to think about those. So I won't say anything else because it's better to hear from him on this. So I'll just invite him to come on up, Dr. Carroll. Let's give him a hand. Yeah.
Well, thanks. Hi, everybody. And it's good to see a group coming out in the afternoon. We're going to talk about immigration, and that's a very complicated topic. And I want to commend you for this series. The older I get, and the gray hair betrays, you know, that I am getting older, I've just come to the conviction that oftentimes with our Christian faith, we don't have the equipment or the wherewithal to even engage these issues. A lot of the Christianity that's taught and preached in our churches is very much about the inner life, you know, and because our culture is so dysfunctional and so many broken people, that's kind of where churches sit. And I get that. But we don't have the equipment to deal with the Charleston. To think about it, and what does it mean? We may pray for them, we may feel badly, but do we have any sense that really the Bible tells us that humans are inherently violent? We're violent creatures. I mean, from Genesis, this is what characterizes human life, actually. Humans kill. It's what we do. We've gotten pretty good at it. We spend billions of dollars a year perfecting the art of warfare. And we have wars all around the globe. We have gangs. This is, if you watch the video games, you see, you get points for killing people. Movies that attract us are movies about the end of the world and invasions, you see. Humans are attracted to this kind of stuff. And oftentimes it'll play itself out in our homes, spouse abuse, child abuse. You'll see it on playgrounds, even little kids, right? The bully. This is part of human life. These are the kinds of things that we need to begin to wrestle with. Because it's part of the warp and woof of the Old Testament. It's grounded in human life and reality and all of its beauty and all of its ugliness. And when the Savior comes, he speaks into this. Of course, he will die a very violent death at the hands of soldiers. And trumped up charges. his people mock him. Even his friends will desert him. I mean, this is the essence of life. So we're going to talk about immigration. That's a complicated one, too. Now, as Norton was saying, I'm half Guatemalan. Now, no one ever believes that because Guatemalans are short. The average male in Guatemala is about 5'9", and something obviously has gone wrong. My father was an American, and he was the son of Irish immigrants. And so my brother, who's older brother, who's 5'6", so he got the Guatemalan body, but he has blue eyes. And, you know, the Irish thing. A very white skin. I'll tan. He'll burn. He has freckles, and we both now have gray hair. That's also from my mother's side. But his hair always was lighter than mine. I mean, this, you know, there was the kind of genetic mix in our family. And I grew up in Houston, and we would drive to Guatemala. It's a four-day drive. Long, long drive. We were raised bilingual, bicultural. I've spoken Spanish, you know, since forever. My mother says it was my first language, could have been. And then I worked there for 13 years at a seminary. And we were raised never really thinking through being the son of an immigrant mother. Never crossed my mind. And maybe because I look Anglo, no one ever asked me, right? I don't speak English with an accent, so no one ever hit me with that. And so I went to live and work in Guatemala City for 13 years, and we moved back to the U.S., now married with kids. We came to Denver. And I remember I had a Peruvian in my class, and he began to say, "Why don't you do something in Spanish?" And what happened was, I didn't tell you this in the morning, what happened was, is when I came to this country, you know, moved back, I hit something I'd never been around before, and that was Hispanics who couldn't speak Spanish. I'd never met anyone like that in my life. I grew up around Spanish speakers. I lived in Guatemala. Everyone speaks Spanish. And then I come here, and then I see people whose last name is Rodriguez or Jimenez or Peña, right? Peña Boulevard, and they don't speak Spanish. Or they speak kind of this Spanglish, right? So I didn't know what to do with Hispanics when I first came to Denver, even though Hispanics, you may not know this, are about 35% of the population in Metro Denver. But we finally started something at the seminary, and this is probably as you were graduating. And we now have a full-scale Hispanic lay program. This year we began offering a degree from the Guatemalan seminary, so we're now their extension here in Denver, in Spanish. But what was interesting to me was now the narratives of the undocumented. And now they had names and faces, and I met their kids, and I go to an Hispanic church most Sunday afternoons, Iglesia El Camino, in Aurora, we would say in Spanish, Aurora, right? About 150 people, almost all undocumented. Most of them have been here for over a decade. Clean houses and cut grass and landscape, construction. Begin to hear the stories. Began to pay attention. I'm going now maybe 8, 9, maybe 10 years ago now. And I began to realize as I would talk to them that the narrative I would hear from them was not the narrative I hear on the radio or on the television. And then I would talk with Christians, and we would have these conversations, and it was about crowded schools and crowded hospitals and Hispanic gangs. It was about the economic impact of immigration and closing the border and drug traffic. But the conversation I was having with those who claimed the Christian faith had nothing Christian about it. It was all about those other things, which you need to get to. But there was nothing Christian about the conversation. So I began to ask myself, how do we think Christianly about this? So are you doing the deal? All right, so we need to kind of move ahead here. If you go into that, okay, there we go. They need to think about it very self-consciously as Christians. Because the media will distort it. On the left, they idealize the immigrant, right? Can't do any wrong. Well, they're sinners, just like you and me. On the right, they get demonized. And you hear language like horde, flood, the tsunami, right? They get demonized as criminals. And we call them illegal aliens, you know, and the only thing illegal is they don't have a paper, right? Most of them are hardworking family people. Aliens, right? We use that for out of space, outer space things, right? You can't do it in Spanish. It's actually a different word in Spanish. But, you know, the wordplay will work in English. Right? So when does an immigrant become a human being and not the alien from somewhere else? Now, if you were to look at the Bible and go to 1 Peter, actually should be 1 Peter 2, not 1 and 2 Peter. But in 1 Peter 2, the apostle will tell us that all of us are strangers and sojourners in this world. See, Christians are different. We have a different king. We should have a different set of values, a different way of living our life. To use the Old Testament language, we are strangers in a strange land. The problem with a lot of us is that this isn't a strange place anymore. We kind of like it. And we claim it as our own. And we try to keep the strangers out. It's all backwards. The strange place is no longer strange. We accommodate ourselves to it in more ways than we probably would want to admit. Now, as I talk about this, what this will mean is that we will begin to look at the Bible with a different lens. Because the Bible is full of migration things, full of migration stories. Old Testament law has all kinds of laws for the foreigner, unique in all the ancient world. God has a heart for the stranger, for the foreigner. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. But a different kind of lens. Now, when I talk about this to non-immigrant audiences, and I have time, tonight's kind of warp speed, usually the response I get is, wow, we didn't know that was in there. Yeah, it's everywhere. And then when I speak to Hispanic, because that's what I know, Hispanic churches, the reaction I get is, wow, we didn't know that was in there. But there's another layer for them. Because they can say, esas son nuestras historias. Those are our stories. Ahí estoy yo. That's me in that story. And I'll share some stories with you tonight that come out of the Bible and they echo the immigrant experience. So, when we move into the Bible, the first thing we have to ask is, where do we begin the discussion? Now, I don't know how much of the Bible you know. You may not know squat. Or you may be like a walking Bible person. I don't know. But when I talk to people of the Christian faith, oftentimes, the first thing they want to think of is, if you know this passage, is Romans 13, right? Submit to the government. And they've broken the law. Well, they have. But if you begin the discussion with legality, which is where the public square will begin the discussion, that's not a discussion, because you have papers or you don't have papers. It's a yes or a no. That's not a discussion. That's just a status. And what I tell people is that, you know, in my Bible, Romans 13 is, it's about page 1,000. And this Bible is actually page 1,100. And there's all this other stuff in front of it. And what we need to do is to begin at the beginning, and you get to Romans 13, but you don't begin there, because all of this stuff here can help us understand how to read this part when we get to it. And if you were to go to the beginning, if you were to go to chapter 1, page 1 of the first book, which is Genesis, it talks about creating humanity in the image of God. Every human being is created in the image of God. Every human being, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of language, regardless of anything, is made in the image of God. All of us have value, infinite value in the sight of God. Now, even that will change immigrant discussion, because it's not uncommon for people to think of immigrants as less than you, as inferior to you, because they look different, or they speak funny, right? But they have infinite worth. The other thing that Genesis 1 will tell us, and then Genesis 2 will add to it, is that every human being also has the ability to rule the earth. And to subdue the earth. Now, in our fallen state, it's in every one of our lives. The ambition that you have, where did you get that? The desire to get better, where did you get that? Well, it's in the image of God. You see, that's you're created to move forward. You were created to conquer. This is how you were wired. You have potential. Every one of us does. You see, now we begin to talk about immigrants not only as image bearers with value, but also as image bearers who have infinite potential. Now you're talking about what they can contribute. And look how that changes the legal discussion. Now you begin to think about laws not about punishing and restricting, but now you begin to think of laws of facilitating. You may have heard discussion over the last few years about the Dream Act, the kids that came with their parents, and you know, they weren't born here, but they don't have status either. So instead of punishing those kids, this is the only country they know, now the question is, how do we facilitate all that potential for the national good? And the whole orientation and direction of law begins to change. Because you have a different starting place. Image bearers. The second thing is to talk about immigrant stories. Let me give you a few. I gave several this morning. I'll give a couple of the same, but I'm going to change one. The father of the faith. Remember who that is? Who is that? Abraham. But it begins as Abram, if you remember that. And in Genesis 11, he begins to move with his family to Haran, which is now on the Turkish-Syrian border. And then he moves south into Canaan when you get into chapter 12. And he receives the promise at the beginning of chapter 12. He begins to build altars and call upon the name of the Lord. But then it says there was a famine in the land, verse 9 and 10. It says there was a famine in the land, so he gathers his family, which would be his wife Sarai and his nephew Lot, and they have servants and animals because they're just Bedouins. And they begin to walk to Egypt looking for food. As you get close to the border, it's interesting, the dynamic, because you see, we know from archaeology that the Egyptians had built a series of forts on their eastern frontier. You see, they had the Nile River. They had water. They had crops. They had harvest. And they were always having people come in during times of famine, looking for food. Some would stay, and some would go back to their homeland. So they're tracking them at the border, we would say. It's probably as they got, Abram and Sarai, as they got close to one of these forts, that he turns to her and he says, you know, if they ask you, tell them that you're my sister, not my wife. If you know that part of the story. And they lie to get across. She plays the part of the sister, and he plays the part of the brothers. They're actually pretty smart, you see. It's very clever, because in the ancient world, since the father was not around, if anyone wanted to marry her, they'd have to ask her brother, so he could kind of fend off some of that. But she's putting herself at great risk, to be perfectly blunt, sexually. But they're willing to lie, they're willing to take that risk, to eat. Have you ever thought of Abram as an immigrant story? How desperate people do desperate things reading the book of Genesis, you come across Joseph, and of course he's taken Egypt. If you know the story, he's the youngest of the sons, and he's the father's favorite, and the father is not subtle about this at all. So his brothers hate him, and they actually want to kill him, but they got talked out of that. They just sell him. And he ends up in Egypt at Potiphar's house. And he's very good, very smart, very loyal, hardworking, honest. And he becomes steward of Potiphar's home. Potiphar goes for a trip, and his wife tries to seduce Joseph. And he runs. But who do you think the Egyptian authorities are going to believe? The immigrant or the wife? Well, they believe the Egyptian wife, and so he's the one who goes to jail. But if you remember the story, he interprets dreams and he comes out. And he interprets Pharaoh's dream, and now he's number two in all the land. And if you read the narrative, what happens is they give him an Egyptian name. They give him an Egyptian wife. He obviously, at this point, can speak Egyptian. But when they have sons, it's interesting, they have two sons, he gives them Israelite names, not Egyptian names. He hasn't forgotten who he is. When his brothers come looking for food again, if you know the scene, they come before him because he's the one who kind of runs this thing, and they don't recognize him, but he recognizes them. Now you go, okay, well, how does that work? I mean, you know, I hear people, well, you know, times change, years go by, and people look different. Yeah, but he recognizes them. Well, if you know the Egyptian culture, it makes perfect sense. A man of his status would have shaved everything and painted his face. So he's painted up. He would have had a headdress because of his status in the government. And that's why they don't recognize him. Now, what happens then is that he understands them. But he's using an interpreter. But he goes behind the curtain and weeps, you know, because he knows what they're saying. And what I tell people is, you see, he hasn't lost his mother tongue. I hear people say, well, why don't they learn English? Okay, you just tell me you don't know any immigrants. English is hard. And I don't know if English is your first or second language, but if it's not your first language, you know, they tell you this lie in school, that English is phonetic. Don't believe that. If I were to ask you, how do you pronounce B-O-W, what would you tell me? Bow or bow. Okay, so let's say that you're a foreigner learning English, and it looks exactly the same, but it has a different sound. Well, how do you know what sound? Well, you just kind of know. And then we have these rules. Was it E before I, except after C? Remember that rule? Well, that makes a lot of sense. And it's just kind of natural for us. And then what happens is certain, you know, cultures can't pronounce certain sounds. You know, Americans can't do the burro. They can do a rrr, they can't do that. So, you know, say burro, a burro. Burrito, burrito. Carro, carro. Okay, they can't do the rrr, right? Which is part of Spanish. Well, if you ask a Spanish speaker certain sounds, they can't do it either, because in Spanish, the TH combination doesn't exist. They will never see the TH combination in the language. So if you say, okay, I want you to pronounce this word, and it's the word three. Tree. No. Three. Tree. Because they don't have that combination. Oh, here's another one, if you know Latins, Hispanics. In Spanish, you cannot be, you may not, I'm taking notes, you should know these things because of your kids. If you begin a word in Spanish with the letter S, you cannot follow it with a hard consonant. Right? So, this is why when you talk to a Hispanic and you say Steve, they go, Steve. Because they can't do st. It's S. Steve. Stop. Right? So, when I'm teasing my friends, I go, okay, just say stop. Stop. No. stop, stop. They can't do it. You see, they're learning the language. And sometimes we have this idea, well, you know, my ancestors are from Germany and they learned English. Oh yeah, they got off the boat and they were just kind of English speakers. No. We know it takes two or three generations. Usually the kids in the schools, they're really the first speakers. But what happens is, this is where it's interesting to engage the immigrant idea. You see, when we talk about immigrants assimilating, we're asking them to negotiate loss. Loss of their language. Loss of cultural values of the family. You know, I was raised with Guatemalan values, and in a Guatemalan family, the mother is very special. And I told my sons, I'm a pretty easygoing guy, but there's one thing I will not tolerate in this house. If you so much as raise your voice against your mother, that will trigger me. Because in a Latin home, that's untouchable. So let's say you're an Hispanic family, you come to this country. Watch the dynamics between kids and parents. So you begin to negotiate those away. Your kids are embarrassed because mom and dad don't speak English, and you have to translate for them into school meetings and negotiating loss. Now, you know, Joseph will reveal himself to his brothers, and they bring the dad, they bring Jacob. But the Egyptians despised shepherds, and so they put them in a corner of the delta. But it's interesting if you read the narrative, because Joseph introduces his dad to the Pharaoh. But that was embarrassing. The most powerful man in the world, and he's introducing his shepherd dad, who would have been despised by the Egyptians, but he says, that's my dad. And the old man reaches over and he blesses Pharaoh. The old immigrant blessing the king. All kinds of stories in the Bible about immigrants. I'm going to go over about 5 minutes again, if that's okay. This one I told this morning, I love to tell this. I'm half Guatemalan, and if you know anything about Guatemala, some of you have been there. Who's been to Guatemala? Woo, a number of you. You get to sit over here, right? These people don't go to Guatemala. These people do go to Guatemala. But if you know anything about Guatemala, you know, one of the staples are black beans. You know, and so we eat black beans all the time. Have them for breakfast, we have them for lunch, we can have them for dinner. And we can do the frijol parado, which is the whole bean. We can do bean soup. We can do arroz con frijol, which is beans and rice. We can do frijol volteado, which is where you mash the beans. And if you've seen this in Guatemala, they're kind of dried and they're mashed. It looks like a meatloaf, and you slice it. And then you put kind of a dried goat cheese on it. And you put salsa. And, you know, when I was growing up and we'd be in school in Guatemala, you know, the big snack was to take pan con frijol. Bean sandwiches. I mean, we do beans. So I tell my students when I take them from Denver, you got to get ready for beans, because beans do things. And you got to get in training for this. That's all that you care. We go to Chipotle. Oh, okay. No, but after about 3 days in Guatemala, Dr. Carroll, for love of God, this kingdom. McDonald's, please. Food. The marker. And when you read the book of Daniel, that's what you find, you see. Daniel, bright, young, good family, probably very wealthy background. He's taken to Babylon. I don't know if you know that story. And most of us gloss over the fact that the empire he was being told to serve was the empire that destroyed his country. That had burned his capital city. That had probably killed his friends and some of his family. The empire that had taken everything away from his family. And now had taken him by force, walking, for 1,000 miles. They change his name and they say, we own you. Because in the ancient world, that's how you would do it. If I change your name, I own you. Because I gave you your identity. They change his name and they educate him for the empire. But that was awkward. What kind of emotions did he feel? The anger. They take everything away. But then he and his friends say, we want our food. That's where we draw the line. When our food, you can't take away our faith. Food's a cultural marker. You know, I didn't say this morning, but you know what? I married a pura gringa, an American, suburban Houston. Right? She'd never been out of the country until she met me. And so we did the premarital counseling thing, but they didn't talk about, like, so what do you eat for Christmas? We didn't talk about that. Well, in Guatemala, the big meal is Noche Buena, Christmas Eve. And it's beans. Of course, it's beans. All right, taquitos, tamales, Guatemalan tamales, which are better than the Mexican ones. You can quote me on that. So my wife goes, no. It's turkey and it's, pie, pumpkin pie, it's pecan pie, it's mashed potatoes, it's the stuffing. It's Christmas afternoon. No. So we've compromised, so we do both, which is great. But if I don't have the beans and the tamales on the Christmas Eve, it's something is missing, you see, the food. The Bible is full of migration stories. Next thing is the law. It's full of laws for immigrants as well. And one of the things that it talks about, it reveals the values behind the law. Because what happens is, if you look at and listen to the debates about law, it's all often about punishing. What does that say about us? If what we want is to punish, what does that say about us? What are the values that drive it? Are they in any way Christian values? Now, when you move into the Old Testament, besides the values, which is the next thing there, the next one, is the Old Testament, these would be vulnerable people. Israel was a peasant economy, and so they'd be needing land to work as peasants, but they couldn't own land in Israel. That came to the families, and so they were dependent on the Israelites for work. They were dependent on the Israelites for help if they got sick or hurt. There was no public hospital, there was no government programs. In the ancient world, that would have been taken care of by extended family. This country, we don't even think about extended family because, we're everywhere. But there you would have lived together. They didn't have extended family. So again, they're dependent. And what the law does is give them a whole series of provisions for food, for protection, equal standing before the law, everything. Fascinating to read. Unique in the ancient world. But then you begin to ask yourself, so why? If you're an Israelite, why do I have to take care of, why do I have to even be open to the foreigner? The Old Testament gives us two reasons why that God gives his people. The first is historical memory. That's the first one. Because what you hear over and over in the law is this. Don't ever forget that once you were slaves in Egypt. Don't ever forget that. The second one is the character and the person of God himself. Now, here's the thing that I want us to think about just for a few minutes. I'm going to show you some slides. We have this idea in the country, well, we're just a melting pot, Statue of Liberty, welcome, all the teeming masses. A little more complicated. The first slide I want to show you, look at it. See, the Irish start coming in the 19th century. You have the potato famine. Thousands upon thousands will die of starvation. Thousands upon thousands will leave to survive. And many will come to this country. My father's family was Irish. This is what we used to think of the Irish. This cartoon is from about 1890. The Irish Frankenstein. Look at the Irishman. He's an animal. Violent. Uneducated. A gun, a knife, dripping blood, another knife stuck in his belt. This is the Irish. I have another slide, which is not here, but on my computer. Help wanted. Irish need not apply. We've forgotten the Irish ghettos of Boston, New York City. For all of that, this is the immigrant story. The next slide is an interesting slide. A little background. Until 1875, in this country, immigration law was state law. This is the perennial tension in this country. States' rights, federal government. If you remember what happened in Arizona, it was about jurisdiction. Who can actually run the immigrant problem in this country? Arizona established its own laws, and the Obama administration took them to court. And they had every right to, because since 1875, it's been a federal jurisdiction. Now, so that's the kind of classic American thing. But as you look at the history behind what I'm going to tell you in just a moment, it's interesting because, you see, 1848, the United States wins the Mexican-American War. We sign the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. 40% of Mexican landmass becomes the U.S. overnight. Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Colorado, California, Nevada. All that becomes U.S. like that. 1849, very next year, we find gold in California and the gold rush begins. And so what we do to build the railroads is we import Chinese labor. We call them the coolies. We import them, the U.S. government does, as does private companies. The problem was that the coolies began to multiply. And that was a problem because we wanted the coolies, but we didn't want their children. And so California passes a series of laws not to allow the women off the boats. That way they won't multiply. There are race riots, lynchings in California against the Chinese. The first major immigration law in the country is the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. Barred Chinese from coming into the country. If you were of Chinese descent and you were born here, you could not be a citizen. And that law was on the books until 1943. Here's another cartoon from about the same period, about 1890. And look at the cartoon. Chinese trying to get over the wall. Someone has pushed the ladder away. Look at the caricature of the coolie. One's just made it over. But they're pushed away. And the whole metaphor of a wall has now become a reality on the southern border. Some things haven't changed, have they? The only thing that changes is the color of the skin, the language. And those who come oftentimes bear the burden of guilt and shame because they're not like the Anglo-majority culture. And what do they have to negotiate away to be somehow accepted? This is the story of U.S. immigration. Next slide. Last slide. Same time period. Here is the ambiguity of American immigration history. United States of America, admittance free, walk in, welcome, but there's Uncle Sam holding his nose. That's the reality of our history. The immigrant is bringing anarchy, disease, and poverty. If you look at his face, probably an Eastern European Jew, that's the caricature. Sabbath desecration, you can see that's from the 19th century. See, this is the history. My mother told me stories of what it was like to come as a Guatemalan woman. I never had to go through that. the humiliation, the mocking. I look Anglo, speak English, no accent. I'm fine. Not her. We forgot. We have some immigrant memories in this country. We have St. Patrick's Day. We all dress in green and drink beer. Green beer. Even if you're not Irish, you drink beer. Oktoberfest, the Germans, right? We drink beer. Columbus Day, it's the Italians, so we drink, you know, red wine or something. But the hard stuff, we forgot. The ghettos. The Japanese, you know, we put them in internment camps in World War II. Why don't we tell that story? Even when they were American citizens, they were put in camps. We don't tell that story, do we? African Americans, the largest immigrant population in the country, we brought them here to work our farms. And made them slaves. Went to Civil War about those immigrants. And then we developed a whole system of segregation so that we wouldn't have to mix with them. So we wanted them. We wanted their labor, we just didn't want them. And now it's the Hispanics. We need their work. 40% of our farm labor is immigrant labor. We just don't want them. So, the stories that we forgot. And maybe in your family you've got stories, but it's probably just a recipe for Christmas. Do you have any of those? Something you do for the holidays because that's what you've always done. We have some friends from a time back when they eat lasagna for Christmas. That sounds awful. But that's the memory. A recipe. But God said, you were slaves in Egypt. Don't ever forget the hard story. And that's what we need to do as this country thinks about immigration, is to remember the stories. Because God was right. If you forget the stories, you'll become the Egyptians. The last thing, and with this I close. The second motivation is at Deuteronomy 10. Because God says, you will love the immigrant because I do. They're vulnerable people. I love them because they're vulnerable. If I were to ask if you're a believer, if you're a Christian, this afternoon. If I were to ask you, how did you become a Christian? You would tell me a tale of woe. Wouldn't you? Time in your life when you were forced to your knees. You would tell me a tale of being vulnerable. Emotionally, financially, family. That would be your tale of woe. But God loves the vulnerable. No matter what kind of vulnerability, economic, social, war. And God says, I love them. And then he says to Israel, you will love them too. I love them by giving them food and clothing, he says. And now you will love them. I mentioned this morning, I'm done. The United Nations tells us that over 220 million people are migrating worldwide. This isn't an American issue. It's a global phenomenon. People fleeing war, famine, earthquakes. How many refugees do you think there are now because of Syria? It's in the millions. They're in Turkey. They're in Lebanon. They're in Jordan. They're getting on boats trying to get to Greece and Italy. By the hundreds of thousands. This isn't an American issue. So the question is, with all of this pain and all of this migration around the world, what does it mean to be the church? And what does it mean to be a Christian? Those are the kind of questions you need to be asking. Are you doing the creed thing?
Yeah.
Okay. If you're interested in any more, I have a short booklet here, some of the Bible piece, but then I have a piece written by a Chinese person in San Francisco. His grandmother came through Angel Island, which is the way that the Asians came in to this country. We hear of Ellis Island. That was East Coast, West Coast was Angel Island, which was not a good place. And then I have one piece here written by a European missiologist. And then here's more on the Bible and immigration. So, I'm over time. Sorry about that. Thank you for your patience. But let's recite the creed, because even if you may disagree with what I've said, we can agree together on this.